Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 High FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Soul to Soul. Wonderful to be with you on this Wednesday afternoon. And we have with us this afternoon a important guest all the way from the United States. Rabbi Shimon Green is with us, and we're so grateful to him to spend this time with us here in the studio. For those of you that don't know Rabbi Green, he is famous here in South Africa. He has many students and has been coming for a long time to South Africa. Rabbi Green was born in the United States. At the age of 17, he went to live in the land of Israel, and he learned Torah for a number of years. He then opened a yeshiva called Birkas HaTorah, which is an outstanding yeshiva in the Old City in Jerusalem. Rabbi Green ran, he built the yeshiva and developed it and took it to great heights. And then he decided on a new journey. And 8 years ago, he left Israel and he's now in Phoenix, Arizona, and building a yeshiva and building Torah, for the Jews of America. So Rabbi Green is somebody who's been involved in education and in teaching Jews for many, many years, and he's a real expert at it, and we're so thrilled to have him with us. So maybe, Rabbi Green, you can tell us a little bit about your views on the situation in the Jewish world today and those issues that are confronting us now in the 21st century.
Okay, you'd be surprised. Whenever I get this question, people expect me to talk about politics or relations between Jews and non-Jews, but when I think about the Jewish situation in this time, what I think mostly about is the difficulty the Jewish people have connecting with their Judaism. And I believe I've been saying this for years, if somebody had asked me bluntly, what's the biggest problem in the Jewish world, I would say that it's just Jewish people are in a bad mood. And that's... above everything. And what I mean to say is that Judaism is, first and foremost, is something to give us a quality of life in this world and quality of life in the world to come. And when people are missing out on this world, it means that by definition they're missing out on Judaism. The Torah was designed to give a person an ecstatic experience of life. I know this sounds it sounds funny to say, but that's the point. A Jewish person is supposed to be having an ecstatic life at all times. And when a person is not having those things, barring times, obviously when a person, God forbid, let's say, is in great pain, that it's almost beyond human for a person to appreciate life, to really, to be enjoying life. But under normal circumstances, the fact that a person is in God's world and the person has the privilege of partaking the magnificent beauty of God's world, something is wrong when a person is not in an ecstatic state. So, I believe that that's the number one challenge we have today, and it's ironic because Jewish people have never been, not in any history that we can remember, they've never been this physically blessed. Our ancestors of 100 years ago, 150 years ago, would think that every one of us was a king and a queen. I know not everybody has money, but today, like every person, we're living the lap of luxury throughout the Jewish world. When I was growing up, I don't mean to talk so long, but I'll just explain myself. When I was a kid, there was an expression called a Jap. A Jap was a JAP was Jewish American Princess. That was a way of, so to speak, of criticizing the fact that the Jewish people were so blessed physically and the kids were spoiled. But I believe that we're the Japs of all Jewish history. In other words, since as long as we can remember, we've never been this physically blessed throughout the world. Nevertheless, that physical blessing is not reflected in the joy and fulfillment in Jewish people's lives. So I think the greatest challenge of all is to get Jewish people to get the gift that God wants to give them. So that's what I'm thinking about, that situation of world Jewry. And everything I see is a problem. I mentioned the use of expression in Europe when they wanted to say that food had spoiled. It's too long since it was cooked. So they would call it too long in America. It's been in America too long. So it's too spoiled. And that's what happens to us, Jewish people, when we are not focused on our Judaism, despite the physical blessings that we have, we're not necessarily having such great lives. So that's my first take on the Jewish world. So I think the number one challenge is to return people to the beauty of Jewish living. And that is a big subject. How do we do such a thing? But that's obviously it has to do with education and a lot of communication.
So how would you describe that to a Jew out there, a traditional Jew? So looking in from the outside, it's difficult to understand and perceive what the spiritual life of Torah observance brings. How would one communicate that effectively?
Okay. Well, that's the $64,000 question. That's what I'm trying to do my whole life. But let's give you an example. When I spend most of my life in Israel, and when I was, quite young in Israel, so a lot of people were not religious. The older generation was really not religious, and people would debate with me all the time. And I remember one time a fellow was debating with me, about being religious. So I finally said, okay, let me just ask you a question. I said, what do you do? What do you do for a living? So he told me he worked in a bank. I said, okay, great, that's fantastic. So I said to him, tell me. I said, on a given day, how many meaningful transactions do you feel that you have with other people? On a given day working in the bank. And he looked at me without hesitation. He said, none. And I said to him, well, here, the facts are they know that I'm a person who learns Torah and I'm in yeshiva. And I have to tell you that on a really slow day, I mean, when really things are not going particularly well, I have at least 12 really meaningful discussions with other people. And that's on a really bad day. And the thing is that, if a person is involved is involved in Torah thoughts and Torah experiences, every day is full of really, really meaningful experiences to the point of exhaustion. As a matter of fact, if a person has a full Torah day, people don't have to work hard to go to sleep. And you listen to people who talk about they can't fall asleep at night. They need something to make them fall asleep. If a person has a Jewish day, is absolutely exhausted, and they don't have to work on going to sleep. They collapse into sleep because the day has been so full emotionally and physically. So just that's one example here. A single other human being is the deepest thing in the world. One other. If there were only yourself and one other human being, that would be enough to exhaust you in a day if you had a proper relationship with that human being. Just what you could share, what you could understand. So I say the first thing, what does it look like? The first thing is here, how much satisfaction are people getting out of their daily relationships? Anyway, I don't know if I'm clear, but that's what I'm, that's just for starts.
Wonderful. Thank you. So one of the Rabbi Green has been giving many wonderful shiurim around town on Shabbos, on Shavuos, and since Shavuos. And one of the themes that Rabbi Green has been emphasizing is how as Jews we're supposed to develop a love for God and a love for our fellow human beings. So when we come back after this break, we will elaborate on that.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We have with us this afternoon Rabbi Shimon Green. Great honor to have him with us here in the studio. Rabbi Green has been emphasizing in the many talks that he's given here in South Africa the fundamentals of Judaism, and in particular the importance of developing in our lives a love for God and a love for our fellow human being. So maybe, Rabbi Green, you can elaborate a little bit on that for us.
Okay, I'd be happy to. First of all, one of the things that has to be understood when we speak about love, from a Jewish point of view, we're talking about an ability that a person has rather than a simple experience that they're reacting to. The Talmud discusses a mitzvah that says a person has to love God with all their heart and all their soul and all their might. And we were discussing earlier, in conjunction to that commandment, the Talmud brings a very interesting story, and that's about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, as everyone knows, is one of our famous sages. And he was among a group of rabbis that would constantly say to themselves, everything that God does is for the good. And it would be like a mantra of theirs. And the Talmud tells a story that one time he was traveling on the road, and people were careful in those days. Being on the road was dangerous. And so everybody made sure to have lodging by nighttime. They didn't travel at night. And he came one night to a certain town, and he asked the people of the town for lodging. For some reason, nobody wanted to give him a place to stay. He said, okay, that's the facts. He knows that what God does is for good. He finds a place in the forest, and he has with him a donkey. He has a rooster. He has a lamp. He figures, okay, he'll be in the night. He has a lamp. He'll be able to learn the Torah, whatever. But everything goes wrong. The lamp is extinguished. The donkey is killed. The rooster is killed. In the morning when Rabbi Akiva wakes up, he finds out that marauders have pillaged the town. And he says to himself, you see, that's what it is, that everything God does is for the good. Had I had the donkey, they would have heard the donkey braying. They would have killed me. They would have heard the rooster crowing. They would have killed me. They would have seen the lamp glowing. They would have killed me. So he understood everything was for good. But what's the point? Why is this an example of a person who loves God so much? And the answer is because the person is looking to see in what is around him, to see the beauty that's there. And this is a particular brand of love that's not necessarily what the world considers love. I mentioned that usually the language of love in the world is passive. It's a language of falling in love, of being blown away, of being smitten. And people are usually reacting to something. I said that there was a very, I can't remember who it was. It was a famous rabbi in Eretz Yisrael. A person said to him, I love fish. He said, no, I don't think you love fish. I think you love yourself. If you love the fish, you'd leave the fish in the water. It's the answer, you love yourself. Most people, when they speak about love, they're talking about some benefit that they get from something or from someone. But when the Torah speaks about love, it's talking about something actually that the person who is in love finds, and even to a certain respect, I don't want to confuse the issue, almost infuses into the world. The truth is that the beauty's there, but because they're almost like they're like a light that shines on everything and sees the beauty of what God did. And that's what puts them into a state of love. The Medrash finds it strange. We have a commandment to love, so the Medrash says, "In any yodea ketzad lehov." I don't know how to love. It's interesting. You think the Medrash says, "How do we love?" So the Medrash says that when a person will study and come to know Mishal Marvayon, a person will know the one who spoke and brought the world into being, then perforce love will settle into a person's heart. I got to tell you, this is a true story. You know, I happen to love music, and when I was a little boy, there was a famous song. And the song was to know him is to love him. And you know, it was written by a Jewish guy, actually. What happened was this guy, his family lived on the East Coast. His father had passed away and they moved out to California. And at one point when he was a teenager, he went back to the East Coast to see his father's grave. And he sees what he saw what his mother had written on the tombstone. And his mother had written, to know him was to love him. That's what the mother wrote on the tombstone. And so this guy went out and he wrote that and became a hit song. But for me, it never left me, because the thing is, that's the truth about Hashem. When a person, the second a person knows God, by definition, they come to love God. Why? Because there's so much incredible beauty there. So if a person will learn and study, they'll come to know. And love, from a Jewish point of view, is a form of appreciation. It's knowing something. It's really grasping what it is. So a person, for example, to love God means a person sees the beauty everywhere in the world that God puts into it. Loving another human being means seeing the beauty that's in every single person. And, I mentioned my father is, you should live and be well. So my father would tease people sometimes. He'd say, okay, you love your kids. Everybody loves their kids. That's an instinct. He said, but do you like them? You know, so you love your kid. You can't stand the kid though. You know, saying, do you like the kid? But the thing is, the truth is that when you really love something, you do like them. Why is that? Because when you love a person, you're really grasping what's wonderful about that person. And, you know, I always tease everybody else. Yeah, there are people who get on your nerves. There are people who drive you crazy. You know, some people, just the way they talk, some people whine and all kinds, you know, there's no question about it. Everybody has somebody like that. But one thing I just want to point out to you, by the way, first of all, you know, if there's somebody that drives you crazy, you can be sure you drive somebody crazy. In other words, there's somebody, you don't think of yourself this way, even though you think you're a nice person, there's somebody when they hear your name, they want to puke. You understand? Everybody is somebody's creep. And why is that? Because the world is diverse. God made a diverse world. And by definition, some people are going to fit with some people and some people are not going to fit with other people. But the truth is, so then how can you have a mitzvah of loving? So I guess, if I have a minute, I'm supposed to explain something. You know, when I was little, I always wanted to know, what does professional mean? You know, you have to say, what's professional? So when I was little, you know, as I started to mature, so professional often meant, do you get paid? You know, professional as opposed to an amateur, but amateur meant you don't get paid and professional meant that you get paid. But later I really got a different definition of professional. And it's really stuck with me. And I think it's true. And that is that the following, when you have an amateur do a job, sometimes an amateur will do inspired work and far superior to what a professional does. The problem with an amateur is that it's not consistent. Sometimes they'll do outstanding work and sometimes they'll do inferior work. You don't know. When you get a professional, you're not going to get necessarily inspired work, but you'll never get work below a certain level. That's what I really understand to be professional. Professional means you're guaranteed less than a certain standard you're not going to get. Inspired part, maybe not great. And but with an amateur, it's hit and miss. You just don't know. And the thing here, what is the there's a mitzvah of loving your neighbor like yourself. Here, you know what? You're not going to be at the top level with every person in the world. But if a person follows the mitzvah that the Torah gives them, they're never going to treat anybody less than a certain standard. There's a professional standard between one person and another. You're never going to be less than that standard. You're going to treat everybody in the same way. And some people here, and the joke is, you know, you don't need a commandment to love people that you like anyway. That wasn't even the issue. So it's so clear that what's funny is people figure, okay, well, that guy I don't have to love, or that person I have to love. But it's on the contrary. That's the one that gets on your nerves is the one that God gave you the mitzvah for. You're going to do to the people that are like-minded, the people that resonate with you. You're going to want to be close to them, want to take care of them. It's with the people that get on your nerves that you have the mitzvah. And the thing is like this, what's so important about it is because a person misses out on a great deal of the world. If they're not a person, if you don't love people, you're missing out on tremendously wonderful, wonderful things. Because the person that you didn't expect it, that you don't expect to love, or said that you don't feel naturally drawn to, you're missing out on the beauty in that person. I got a story I got to tell you. I was just about to say it's a true story. The truth, every story I tell is true, unless I tell you it's not true. That's always the issue. If it's not true, I'll tell you it's not true. But when I was a much younger, so we were going to record a ballad. I told this story last night, and you know, a recording studio costs money, you know, so you want to always rehearse as much as you can before you go, so you don't waste money. A recording studio is like the most expensive taxi, you know, you've ever taken. And what's terrible about it, you can't think about it, you know, because you have to relax to make music. I was just telling last night, so for example, you know, and here to make music, you have to talk, you have to relax, you got to tell a joke, whatever the story is. That joke might cost you $200. but you can't think about it. If you think about it, you know, then you're finished. Anyway, but so that's in the studio. But before you go, you try and rehearse as much as you can so that everything will be good. So we were going to record a ballad of mine. And my friends, we were all learning in yeshiva, and I asked my friends to do me a favor and to rehearse this song during lunch. So everyone agreed, and we went out for lunch, and it was a big favor. And we sit down to play, and it's a very sweet song we're going to play. We count the song in, you know, a few bars or whatever it is into the song, and all of a sudden the drummer loses his mind. And instead of playing something that would be appropriate for a ballad, you know, something sweet and flowing, he plays this insane jazz riff, like, ta-ta. It was such a non sequitur. It was funny. And everybody started laughing. And it was the truth. It was great. It was a great way to break the ice. Everybody's laughing. It's okay, you know, that's very funny. Okay, let's go. And we count the song in again. But then about four bars in, he does the same thing again. You know, he plays this insane jazz riff. Well, the second time people laughed, but they didn't think it was so funny. They said, okay, hey, stop it. You know, let's get going. You know, we're skipping lunch. Let's rehearse the song. So we crank it up again. And the third time he does it again, and everybody just got upset with the guy. They said, look, you're in a crazy mood. I'm not going to give up lunch, you know, for you to be crazy. And they walked out. Now I'm finished, you know, my band left, and I'm just myself with this one guy. And what am I going to do? Well, I got no place to go. He looks at me very quietly and he says, play it again. I said, okay, you know, and I start to play, and four bars in, he starts to do the same crazy thing that he was doing before. And I didn't know what he was doing. It was just nuts, you know, but we were the only people there, and I just kept trying to play somehow to push my way through it. And I couldn't really follow it, but I kept going. But then about like halfway in, I realized like he really had something there. He kind of saw something. And about three quarters of the way in, even though I was struggling to keep up with what he did, I realized that he really heard my own song in a way that I had never heard it. And when we finished, I realized that he really, really had something. And he looked up very quietly and he said, play it again. And this time we played it the second time through, and I was transported. And I realized that this person, he'd heard my song from another dimension, and it was absolutely beautiful. And when we finished, you know, I looked up. My wife says I shouldn't tell this story, but I looked up and his face was shining. I mean, shining. And a little voice inside of me, you know, this is a person I sat next to every day. And a little voice inside of me said, you know, you've never seen this person before. And then the same voice said, no, you know, not you've never seen this person before. You've never seen anybody before. And the truth is, I'm not exaggerating. Looking back, that was the first time I ever saw anybody in my entire life. I'd never seen a face before that moment. And my life has never been the same since then. And what I'm trying to say is like this, that if we don't take advantage and do the mitzvah of loving a person, particularly when they get on our nerves, you know, the people that you don't, that you're not naturally attracted to, you're going to miss out on incredible beauty. Cause you only, if you only relate to people like yourself, you understand? That's a very, such a small percent of the world. What a boring, crazy world. And I gotta tell one thing quickly. Like, here, you know, there's two ways to make a peaceful world. One way is to make everybody the same. Every single person be the same. You know, what do you like? What you like? You know, what do you eat for breakfast? Same as you eat. Where do you want to go? Wherever you go. But what a boring, gray, ugly world that would be. You'll have complete peace because everybody just does the same thing, but you'll be bored to distraction. But there's another way that God makes a wonderful world. He makes people diverse, incredibly different, every single person different, and then gives us a mitzvah and say, now, you're right, you're going to have a problem because everybody's diverse. This one's going to get on your nerves. This one's going to have the timing that's off. This one's going to come at the wrong place and do the wrong. This one's too loud. This one's too quiet. But if you treat everybody with love, then you can have all, you can gain all the diversity. So what I'm trying to point out is that people think of my obligation to love somebody in order to benefit them. It's true. But the truth is it benefits ourselves because we're missing out on the beauty of all those people if we don't love them.
Beautiful. It's not easy. One has to work hard sometimes to love those that, that aren't naturally those that they love. So that's love for a fellow human being, which is really beautiful. How does one generate a love for God?
So it's this point that I told about this song before, you know, it says, you know, to know him is to love him. If a person, it's an interesting thing, you know, people also that one of the problems, you know, we talk about learning Torah. So the problem is that most people, if you talk about learning or studying, they're thinking of university or school. And it really, there's almost no connection between what we call learning from a Jewish point of view and what the world calls learning or study from a secular point of view. Because what learning really means is that a person is engaged at the deepest place with someone else. And in this case, a person engages in the deepest place with God. I'll explain what I mean. When I study the Torah, or a person studies the Torah, first, you're just hearing things that make sense. But there has to be a point where you're going to hear something that you've never heard before, and something is revealed to you. And when a person really studies the Torah, they begin to see what it is that God put into this world, and they become sensitive. And you look at things from a different perspective. I want to just get, but listen, pull something out of the air. You know, we have a great obligation to take care of other human beings. One of those obligations is called charity. Sometimes people fall on unfortunate circumstances, and it's our obligation to help them. And you would think that the more dire circumstances a person is in, the greater our obligation to support them. But you know, it's not always true. Sometimes it's the other way. Sometimes a person who's in less dire circumstances gets our support before a person who's in more dire circumstances. I'll give you an example. Let's say there's a person who unfortunately is so destitute or so poor that they walk from door to door to collect money just to be able to eat, to take care of themselves. There's another person whose business is failing, and that person is in danger of losing the business. Well, ironically, so long as it's not a matter of life and death, even though normally you would think, well, the person who has so little money, they have to collect to get a meal. You would think, well, this person still has a business, so I should support that. I should support the person going to door to door first. But ironically, the rabbis teach us that the person who's about to lose the business, we better support first. Why is that? Because since it's not a matter of life and death, ironically, the person who was walking door to door, unfortunately, has already had to suffer the embarrassment of collecting for himself. It's a sad thing, but unfortunately, the person's already had to suffer that. But this person who has a business going and has never had to suffer that embarrassment, we rather want to first help him so that he doesn't have to come to that place. So it makes sense once you hear it, but it's something novel. But what I'm trying to point is, in order to come to that conclusion, we have to have empathized with both people and seen where they're at and then made a decision. And it's the same thing when we study God's Torah and we study God's mitzvahs, all of a sudden we become very sensitive to the world around us to see what God did. And the more we see that God did, the more we fall in love with him. You know, I went to yeshiva all my life. That means I was in a boys' school. We have enough time to tell the story?
Sure. Please.
So I was in a boys' school. Now, boys are boys. And in my house, we had a kitten that we took off the street. And the kitten grew up with us. And then it was a female. And then she got pregnant. And the night she gave birth, I was up with that kitten, with that was a cat. I was up with the cat all night watching the cat give birth. I was probably about the, you know, probably about 14 years old. And I lost my mind. I couldn't believe it. The little kittens were born. The mother cut the umbilical cord and then cleaned out their nostrils, you know, so that they could breathe. And then the kittens, you know, find the mother and able to nurse. And now imagine, I'm a boy and I'm coming to an all boys school. You know, boys are boys. You see? And the next day, I couldn't shut up. All I could talk about, I couldn't believe what I saw. I said, well, you know, I said, we had this cat since she was a kitten. She didn't go to cat school. How did she learn how to have a baby? How did she learn how to cut the umbilical cord? How did she know how to clear their nostrils. I didn't know how to do this thing. I was out of my mind. Really, I realized what Hashem put into every single creature in the world. So the more you pay attention, how do you come to love God? Just pay attention to what's around you. The world is such a delightful place. Even you just take a shower and you get a towel. You know, I think incredible. You know how it feels when you dry yourself and you put a towel on your neck. Ah, it's the most incredible feeling in the world. That's all that good feeling. You know, when you wipe yourself with a towel, say that's something God did. It didn't just happen by accident. That's something God, the very feeling, that just exquisite feeling, you know, instead of, wiping yourself down with a towel. That's something God created. Deja vus are something God created. Your foot falling asleep is an incredible experience. That's something God made up. Artichokes are something God made up. You know, everyone else thinks so knowing God, but one, by seeing the world and appreciating it, and two, my learning is Torah, and the Torah draws your attention to the beauty of every detail, every single detail of the world. Here, a person who studies the laws, let's say laws of keeping kosher. Well, then a kitchen is not just a kitchen. There's pots absorb, and there's different flavors, and there's different ways to take the absorption out of a pot. So a person has an exquisite sensitivity. If a person studies the laws of Shabbos, all of a sudden, a private domain and a public domain and a median area, all of a sudden everything. The whole world is incredibly alive. A person notices differences between everything. And the Torah catalogs the millions upon millions upon millions of details in this world and cherishes everyone. I still got them in here. I'll just explain this. There's a word that we use in the Torah called kadosh, holy. But the word holy means unique. It really means unique. For example, when Jewish people get married, the word we really use is kiddushin. Men and women, we don't really say that men and women get married. We say that they sanctify each other. What does that mean? If a man marries a wife, he's saying, you know what? When he's sanctified, he says, you're unique. There's nobody like you in the entire world. A woman says, you're unique. There's nobody like you in the entire world. When we study God's Torah, we sanctify every detail of the world. We see it for what it is. We are falling in love with. We see, wow, this one moment or this one place is uniquely beautiful, differentiated from all the millions of other moments and places. So we're coming to sanctify every single thing in the world and to fall in love with it. And that by recognizing how it's uniquely beautiful. I tell my wife that as far as I'm concerned, I say to my wife, compared to you, all the rest of the women in the world are men.
Beautiful. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So we have with us Rabbi Shimon Green, and Rabbi Green is sharing with us some wonderful insights about being a Jew and about loving God and loving our fellow human beings. Our show, usually we dedicate towards understanding the depth, who the sages were, and their tremendous contribution to the Jewish people and to all of humanity. So Rabbi Green will maybe share with us some insights into some of the sages.
Okay, so I want to make two points about the fact that we look up to other people and what it means. There's first I want to discuss what the word rabbi really means. You know, people think rabbi, great person, a teacher. Oh, but there's something. There was in the 1970s in New York, there was a policeman who joined the police force in New York, and unfortunately, he found it to be corrupt. And he wrote a book that describes his attempts to straighten things out, etc. But that's not really my point. There was a very famous book called Serpico, but In the book, there's something amazing, and that's this. There's a, at a certain point, he's describing the hierarchy in the police department and how one person might help another. And it turns out that they have a slang word in the police department called rabbi. And they'll say, who's that policeman's rabbi? What's a rabbi in the police department? Every policeman has another policeman who's much further advanced in the police department than he is, who's looking out for his career. That's called the guy's rabbi. And I read the book and I said, whoa, how did they know what a rabbi is? And they're really right. What is a rabbi? A rabbi is a person who's more advanced than we are, who's looking out for our welfare. Somebody's looking out for our career. So when Jewish people are looking up to the sages, what we're looking at is somebody's that's further along the pathway that we are, that's going to do us the favor of helping us advance along the same pathway that they did, because they have the experience. They're going to help us make it. So the first thing is that, and one of the most beautiful things, the real job of a teacher and our sages is to show us how it's done. Show me, how do you do it? I understand in theory, everybody knows it, but how do I actually do it? And that's why, for example, the Torah tells us that it's greater, what's called greater than learning from our teachers is actually being close to them and watching them. Why is that? Because you can hear things in theory, but when you watch a person actually do it, then you really know how to be successful at life. In any case, there was one of the great sages, which everyone knows, we can call it the previous generation, maybe it's already two generations, was the Chafetz Chaim, or Yisrael Meir Cohen of Radin. And there's a famous story that he was once called to be a character witness, in a certain court case in Poland, and the judge called the lawyer to the bench, and the judge says to the lawyer was Jewish, you know, and so the judge says, you know, I've heard these incredible things about this rabbi, like really astounding stories. He says, are those stories true? So the lawyer says to the judge, he says, judge, look, he says, I don't know if they're true or not, but one thing I know, they don't tell those stories about me and you. So the first thing is to understand that when we look towards the rabbis to show us how do we actually succeed in doing what we theoretically know that we're supposed to do. That's the first point I want to make. Another important point is that we should look at the great people of the past. There's no question about it. But I just want to emphasize that it's extremely important to look at the great people of our own time. And actually, I believe, much more important. And why is that? Because Judaism is a great chain since the beginning of time, but let's say particularly from the time of Sinai. And you have to realize that every generation speaks a different language. And maybe there's a little different direction than we wanted, but I want to explain it. The most important people, the most important sages are the ones that are alive today. And I'll explain why. You know, they have, here, I'll explain. You know, if you know in England, they have these famous gentlemen's clubs. You know, they're famous. You know, you have to be wealthy to get into them, and even be invited is a big deal. So there's a famous story where this young man, you know, gets an invitation to visit, you know, to visit this club, and it's like such a big deal, and he's amazed, and the elder person who takes him, you know, it's his sponsor, and he comes in, and the place is all full of mahogany, and you know, it's hundreds of years old, whatever the story is, and he comes in, he's very intimidated and impressed with the place, and then he hears someone say 17, and everyone starts laughing. You know, so he's figuring, kind of, what's going on here? And then he walks a little further in, and somebody says 14, and everybody starts laughing. He says, what are they all? They've been so old, what are they all going crazy? So he looks at his sponsor. He says, what's going on? So the sponsor says, you know, everybody here is so old. He says, they've told all the jokes that they know, you know, a million times already. So nobody bothers to tell the jokes anymore. They just give every joke a number, and they say the number, and then everybody starts laughing. So the guy says, okay, well, at least they're not as crazy as he thought, you know. And they walk a little further down the hall, and somebody calls out 23, and no one laughs. So the kid looks up at the old man. He says, what happened? He says, that guy doesn't know how to tell a joke. He says, anyway, the story's like this. You'll know that if you've ever had a shared experience with someone here, then there's a lot that you understand. And another person who hasn't had that shared experience won't understand. So let's say you and I, you know, we have a long history and we haven't seen each other in a while, or we sit down and I'll say to you, hey, remember what happened in 98? And we'll start laughing. Well, of course we have it, but the person who didn't have the experience with us in 98, they can't laugh. Well, in every generation, conversation, language changes and connotations change. To give you an example, in the United States in the 1920s, if you wanted to say somebody was impressive, you call them hot. That person was hot. You know, saying, well, in the 50s, you never would call a person hot. You'd call them cool. You know, saying, but that was in the 50s. But in the 60s, you didn't call somebody cool. You called them heavy, you know, in the 60s. But then in the 70s, you wouldn't call somebody heavy. You call them light. You know, saying, and then in the 80s, you'd call them bad. And then in the 90s, you'd call them awesome. And in 2000, you'd call them sick. So which is the word? You know, saying the answer is in every, and if you try to use the wrong word, the wrong generation, nobody would know what you're talking about. So if a person grew up in a time where the way you describe somebody's cool or somebody says somebody's hot, they have no idea what anybody's talking about because language and times change. So there has to be a way this is really the number one job of all of the sages throughout Jewish history. And that's this. Here, just like I told you that if we have shared experience, then we can laugh at a joke that somebody else can't laugh at unless we give them the background. If we tell them the whole story of what happened in 98 and then they know, then we say 98, they'll also laugh at the joke. Well, the same thing happens in every generation. The rabbis realize that the people that they are teaching haven't had the connection to the people that those rabbis learned from. And therefore, the people they're teaching, if they hear from the generation that's two generations back, they won't get the point. They won't get the joke because the same words don't mean the same things anymore. They really don't. Here, I'm not testing you. Do you know what a cooper is? A cooper is a person who made barrels. That's what a cooper was. And do you know that coopers had special tools? Today, cooper's tools would be meaningless to you. They were a lifetime for people. You go into a museum today, you'll see cooper's tools. But that means nothing. Or how about a button hook? You know, your great grandparents used to close their boots with a button hook. That was fraught with meaning. I said, these things mean nothing to us until somebody's going to sit down and explain to us. So how are we going to connect? How are we going to connect generation to generation, the eternal Torah? The answer is we're going to have somebody that's going to grab our hand and hold our hand while they're holding in the hand of the generation before them ad infinitum to all the generations. So the job, the reason why we look up so much to the sages, besides their piety, besides their knowledge, because they did us the favor of translating from generation to generation. And that's why I guess maybe you won't expect me to say this, but really the number one sages that you have to look at are the ones that are alive in their time, because they're the ones that are going to grab our hands and connect us to all of Jewish history and all of Jewish learning.
Wow, it's a great insight. Thank you so much. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
It's really been a lot of fun having Rabbi Green with us in the studio. We only have a few minutes left. Rabbi Green is also, not only is he a Rosh Yeshiva and a well-known Talmid Chacham, a great Torah scholar, but Rabbi Green is also a musician, and he's been playing music his whole life. So maybe, Rabbi Green, you can share with us some insights and some valuable experiences that music has brought to you.
Okay. So one point I would say is like this, that first of all, all my life, I actually want to know what music has affected me very deeply, as I think it affects people all over the world. It's hard for us to explain what it is, and I was always puzzled by music, because I know that, like I say, it affected me so profoundly, but I didn't know what it was. And until I finally saw an article, there was a very famous rabbi who we know as the Alter of Slobodka, the Elder of Slobodka, Rav Nassim Tzvi Finkel. And he essentially says that music connects with the fundamental structure of the universe. And what I mean to say is that, in other words, we're connected to the deepest things in the world. I got to tell a story. I can't help it. When I was about 15 years old, I think, you know, I was at home one day. It was just myself and my brother. And I don't know, for want of a better word, I had a religious experience. So I was so excited, you know, I ran downstairs and I called my brother's name. And he found me and he said, you know, what's up? And I looked at my brother and I recited the Olenu prayer, the prayer that closes all of our prayers, Jews say every day. And I recited it word for word. My brother's a very patient person, and he stood there while I recited the entire Olenu prayer from beginning to end. And then he looked up, he said, okay, what about it? I said, you know, those are several hundred syllables that are burnt into my brain. and they don't mean anything. And it wasn't because I couldn't translate them. It was because they were rolling off my back. And at that point I made a certain decision, believe it or not. I'd always, you know, loved music. And as a kid growing up, we sang in Hebrew. And, I still sing in Hebrew. But at that point I decided to stop singing in Hebrew and to start singing in English. And the reason was because my whole purpose in music was to be able to communicate things that were hard to communicate in verbally. And I wanted, so, and I didn't want to be held back in the communication. So I decided to sing and also to sing in English. And, often I tell people that as far as I'm concerned, when I sing, it's exactly the same thing as when I teach. There's no difference. Singing and here, learning and teaching Torah or singing for me the same. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't bother. You can communicate things in songs that you can't communicate verbally. In fact, it's a funny thing. A lot of people are unhappy with me because people want me to explain my songs to them. And I always tell them that I won't explain the songs because the songs themselves are supposed to be explanations of other things. If I start explaining the song, you'll never get the point. The whole point was to have the experience of the song, you know. So, but that's what I do. And I've always been connected to it. And I've always been very thankful, you know, very thankful to God for music because I mean, you can see that you can communicate things that you can't communicate without it. A number of years ago, I went to visit somebody who I didn't know. I mean, I just meeting the person. And I walked in and the person said, "Are you my name?" You know, I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you have a song called Beis Medrash?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you know, I keep Shabbos because of that song," you know, and I was so thankful.
Wow. Amazing. Really amazing. The power of music, the power of Torah, the power of love. Thank you, Rabbi Green. It's been wonderful interviewing you, having you with us. And we thank you for being in South Africa with us. We hope to see you again soon. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.